This week on Decentralized, the Grecian debt crisis, the future of ownership. Then we talk to Manuel Arroz, co-founder of Streamio.
I'm Tony Sakic.
I'm Jazz Bergeson.
I'm James Walpole.
And I'm Eric Martindale.
And this is Decentralized.
So the big news this week in Bitcoin and sort of in the decentralization space in general is the monetary and financial crisis going on in Greece right now. And right now, average Greek citizens are finding as a result of capital controls that they can't withdraw more than $67 or 60 euros from their banks right now. A lot of people in the Bitcoin space have been sort of maybe a little bit gloating about this and looking at this as sort of a confirmation of the need for decentralized money. But it's really interesting and also sort of tragic what's going on over there right now. From what I understand, this has been going on for a very long time with Greece's sort of debt accumulation from the IMF, from the European Central Bank, and from other members of the Eurozone like Germany. But it does seem to be sort of coming to a head now. And I think through July 6th, the banks are closed, and people are going to be having a hard time of it over there. But I guess I wanted to highlight this as sort of not to gloat, but sort of look at this and say, how can actually decentralized technologies help people of Greece right now? Because certainly with Bitcoin, certainly with other solutions, people will need to have some tools to get around what's going on with these centralized institutions crumbling all around them.
Yeah, I think it is a good thing, but what bothered me, and what you said was true, was the Bitcoiners and the people that are into decentralizing that are gloating. And you didn't sound gloating at all, don't worry, but I have seen a lot of the comments made on the internet about it, and it's like, look, we're trying to tell these people that this way's better. You don't do that with, ha-ha, mine's better, ha-ha, mine's better. And now, it's a small percentage of the group that's doing it, but man, it makes me uneasy because that's not how to act right. Like, my parents didn't teach me that way. They taught me to help others, you know? Maybe a minor comment, but what you said, that's what jumped out at me first and foremost. And then what was second was, you know, that maybe people are going to learn and they're going to figure out, you know, better options, like things we talk about on this show.
So what's interesting to me, and I haven't seen anybody gloating about this, but the thing that's, I haven't seen anybody like, ah, ha, 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 but what I have seen is Bitcoin speculators really excited for this. And that bothers me deeply, is I see people, you know, posting like, oh yeah, now the price is going to go up, now the price is going to go up. And it is, okay, sure, but that is so far beyond the point. Like, there are people over there, there's... Like, I don't know if you've seen some of the videos and some of the news. It's what's actually happening over there on the ground as a result of this capital control. There are grandmothers who literally cannot go get cash to buy food, right? Like, there are people on the ground suffering over there, and that's terrible. I think this does strike a chord with people that were not deeply engaged previously, right? They might have been aware of something and just... They didn't really put two and two together to go back 6 years and look at, you know, sort of the launch of Bitcoin and realize that this is exactly the case where Bitcoin is useful and why it is so fundamentally important. This is the fundamental reason why we have to do everything we can to help people, right? To give people pieces of technology that prevent centralized controls from causing this type of pain, right? If the entire world was on Bitcoin already, this type of default would not impact the citizen because you can't put capital controls in place on a decentralized technology. There's simply no way to do it. I've seen a couple other interesting comments from, you know, like Coinbase, for example. They're saying that they're seeing like a 300% increase in people trying to get Bitcoin in Europe, which it's like it's frustrating because... You know, there's been so much effort put into spreading the word and, you know, saying, hey, guys, this is coming, this is coming, this is going to happen. Like, countries are going to start instituting capital controls. Centralized parties are going to start asserting control over your monetary freedom. And that's a form of free speech. And people just, I don't know how to accelerate that other than simply say, hey, guys, like, let's find a way to bring Bitcoin to these people and help them acquire it so that they can be much more protected from efforts like this.
It seems to really mirror a lot of the boom and bust cycles we've seen. That, you know, I think people associate the problem with the bust. The problem is what's happening right now, the after effects, the capital controls. This is all kind of the results of like a long slide to where Greece is today and where a lot of these countries are today. And I guess maybe the key is sort of getting to that point with Bitcoin, with anything else, maybe with just economic theory in general, where we can identify, you know, sort of when things are normal, what's going on, what's really fragile about the system, because you're in a pretty fragile system when banks can just take your money. And it's like hard for me to imagine, because I think obviously we're in a place where it's not really as common to see that, though it's happened before. It's happened before in Cyprus. It's happened before everywhere, and there's always theft going on. But yeah, I mean, I like what you're saying about Coinbase. I think they offered removal of fees for anyone purchasing Bitcoin on their service. There are a lot of companies stepping up to provide practical solutions to this. I'm sure a company like Eric Voorhees, a company he previously founded, Coinopolis, will have a lot of value there. Just anything to sort of show people what the most important part of Bitcoin is. And which we only really realize at times like this, which is probably, you know, the fact that you can control your own money. One of the things, you know, all of us probably struggle with is working this space, and particularly in Bitcoin payments, as we all have at some point, is why consumers should adopt Bitcoin. And it's hard to come up with reasons to that if you're ignoring the sort of basic thing about controlling your own money, which people only really value in cases like this. Again, like not to gloat or point some kind of moral to this story, because the story's not over, and because I really have no right to make that kind of moral condemnation of people. But it's interesting, and I think as long as we're kind of doing maybe things to communicate these ideas or make it easier, like a lot of these companies are stepping up to do, hopefully we'll get to a good place with this.
Absolutely. Very well said, by the way. And you know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of someone that I admire by the name of Charlie LaDuff. And let me go full circle here and say, you know, this happened in Detroit, my hometown, you know, a few years ago. And it recently also happened to Stockton, California, the cities that went bankrupt. You know, Detroit's a much bigger city. But, you know, when this happened, I also remember seeing Charlie LaDuff, who's kind of a local journalist legend in Detroit, crazy, cool guy. Him basically going on, you know, the Lettermans and the Daily Show and basically saying what happened here in Detroit is going to happen to other places. It's math, you know, that it will happen. He didn't say specifically where. He's like, it could happen to America. And at the time, it was like, you know, this isn't real. Like, no, this ain't going to happen. And then now that I look back on it, I'm like, well, yeah. And if you're not paying attention, you know, I don't know how much we as people can fix this. But what I do know is you can, if you pay enough attention, you can at least make sure that your own ass is covered as much as it is. Sorry for the crassness, but that's the only way I can explain it. And that's something that I really took to heart. And there's a book that I'm actually almost done with by Charlie LaDuff called American Autopsy. My mom bought it. She really liked it. So I was able to get an e-version. And really, really fascinating book. And when you see how it affects people in your neighborhood, because I lived in Detroit when this happened, you know, I was actually there. It's very strange. It's strange when you have to call, you know, 911 and you don't get a response for an hour or two. It's, you know, these little things that you maybe take for granted, and then you see that these are the people, there's an entire country now that could be having these issues. It's very sad, and I really, really hope that there are decision makers paying attention to not just podcasts like ours, but to other people that are seeing this giant iceberg, right? And let's see how much of the ship we can save, because it may be a year, it may be a century before it hits the fan, but eventually it will hit the fan, in my opinion.
So let's rewind just a little bit and sort of understand how Greece got themselves into this situation. I think it's a pretty much a one-for-one comparison as to what happened in Cyprus, at which point, yes, of course, the Bitcoin ecosystem got a very big boost in interest when Cyprus went similarly bankrupt and instituted capital controls. Detroit and a number of cities and even states all around the United States sort of went through this, you know, in the collapse of the housing bubble and the housing markets, which cascaded very similarly. So Greece, as I understand it, I'm by no means a poli-sci sort of person, but As I understand it, they took a loan out to basically help the economy from the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. And as part of that loan came certain conditions which instituted certain policies that must be enacted in order for Greece to take this loan and, in theory, make their economy better. So this is the International Monetary Fund. This is a nation state of, you know, global scale, a major member of the European Union, which is roughly the equivalent of the United States anyways over there. This is like a really big deal. So they took all of these centralized opinions as to the rules that they need to enforce to make their economy good enough to pay back that loan, and this is part of the loan terms. And it was called austerity. And the problem here is that the policymakers are actually, because they're centralized and it's a hierarchical structure, they are so far removed from the reality of the on-the-ground situation, the edge of the network, that they're simply incapable of making competent decisions about the economics at that scale. We've talked about, you know, Keynesian versus Austrian economics in the past, but I think, and I don't want to like point in any one particular direction and lead people on. I want people to sort of recognize the friction between having a centralized system that results in, you know, this distance from understanding of the actual people on the ground who are the essence of that country's economy. And it's like, what happened here is the rules that they instituted actually made things significantly worse. In fact, so significantly worse, these austerity measures have resulted in the country being, it is simply on paper, mathematically, impossible for them to repay the debt, and so they're defaulting.
Yeah, no, it's the same story, I guess, you've seen many times. I mean, you saw this in a... Actually, Italy has a very interesting history of this. There's a great book called As We Go Marching by John Flynn, who is a journalist during sort of the progressive era in the United States around the time of the Great Depression, World War II. And he actually looked at Italy's history from the 1890s onward, where they just accumulated debt upon debt in order to fund various internal improvements and public projects and things like that. Really traces it very well to fascism, and I certainly hope that doesn't happen in Greece. But I guess one of the alternatives to this, and something which you brought up, Eric, was is sort of looking at this from a different economics perspective. Look at the problems of central planning that have brought Greece this far. And I did want to recommend to our listeners, if you enjoy our reading suggestions that we make every now and then, check out that work by Flynn. It's interesting if you like history, but also if you kind of want to understand a really interesting perspective on sociology and economics, and if you want to understand kind of what decentralization, like one of the cornerstone works of decentralization is F.A. Hayek's The Use of Knowledge in Society, which is a lot about pricing, a lot about sort of the price system and how that coordinates knowledge in a decentralized manner, but it's very relevant to just about any kind of economic planning discussion.
I actually am someone who is nowhere near as up on economics as you are, James, but I will say this. Hayek is my favorite economist, and you're right with what your last comment was. There's many aspects of life, your career. It's helped me, like, just understanding general principles helps me in marketing. I recommend reading him a lot to anyone who's interested, so thumbs up on that. I co-sign to the 10th degree, so...
So this is interesting to me, not just from the economics of nation states. And again, we'll put the links to the essays that Hayek has actually written on this in the show notes. But it applies. This is a very generic concept that applies, in my opinion, to every system. And this is one of my fundamental principles for why decentralization is the only answer here. The further removed you are from the people being impacted by a decision, the less efficient information transit can become across that. You can look at it like mathematical graph theory, where the single most efficient graph is a single node with no other nodes and no edges. You can instantaneously transit information to yourself. It's there. It's already present. Therefore, the individual is the most enabled and the most empowered, the most informed. Once you start adding other nodes to that graph, and it maybe gets a little bit bigger, you start to get edges forming between those nodes. And to route information across those edges in that graph is a non-zero cost. Now, it can be, you know, very close to zero. It can be epsilon, right? It can be tiny. But the fact is that it is non-zero, and it cannot be zero because you are now moving information from place to place. You can break this all the way down to the physics level, right? Like, there is always a non-zero cost because we can't exceed the speed of light, and that is the speed of information. So the more nodes you add to this graph, the larger and more complex a system becomes, and the further across that graph, points A and B, the people who are impacted by the decision and the people who are making the decision, the further those are apart, the more nodes they have to traverse, and therefore, subsequently, the more additively inefficient graph traversal becomes. And as a result, this applies, obviously, in the case of Greece, to economics. It applies to organizational theory and, you know, corporations, corporate governance. It applies to small groups. It applies to startups. It applies to interpersonal relationships. It applies to education. It applies literally to every system on Earth, because these are socio-technical systems and they rely on people being able to communicate. No one person can do everything, therefore you must communicate. So it's necessary for us to empower the individual rather than defer a decision to some authority, which is by its very nature removed from the party on the ground impacted by those decisions.
Very well said, Eric. That really expresses very well kind of what decentralization means on the information level. And one of the things which is interesting, looking at sort of networks and how they're affecting kind of ownership and individual control, is sort of what the blockchain does with money. Which is what we're kind of talking about earlier, this idea of assigning ownership via a distributed ledger. It's kind of very different from any kind of concept of ownership we've had before, but at the same time, it's far more secure than any kind of ownership we have currently, as you can see with sort of these capital controls and what's happening with bank runs, what happened in Cyprus with confiscation of funds. Now we have something that's entirely digital and is entirely like a tokenized basis for assigning property rights and something. It's kind of a commons and a private property system at the same time, which is what's really interesting about Bitcoin to me. And I know Jeffrey Tucker's done some writing on kind of what this is all about. But one of the things that I did want to talk to you all about with this ownership question, because it's so vital to the people in Greece right now, but it's also really vital to, I think, any kind of discussion of digital technology, is how things like the blockchain, how things like peer-to-peer services, how things like even streaming for music, as we've discussed on the show before, are affecting our concepts of owning things. And one of the observations I've seen a lot and repeated a lot, and I think it's increasingly true, is that there's less of a need to own capital. When you have services like Uber, when you have things like the blockchain where your property is embedded on a distributed digital ledger, when you have digital books, digital music, you don't really need to own things anymore. And I wonder if you all see the same trend, and what do you think that means for individuals?
I definitely see the same trend. And I think it comes back to a very old quote by Stuart Brand when in the 80s said, information wants to be free. Information also wants to be expensive. That tension will not go away. And that's really something that has spoken true for a long time. And it's now truer than ever because of the ease that we can all get information. I really, at the heart of it, believe information's free. There's really no, you know, it's like when you download an album, there's no real cost in pressing it. There is a cost in creating it. And, you know, that's where one issue comes from. And where this kind of got added, and we were talking a little bit about it off air, was for journalism. And that was one that concerns me the most because of how essential and important journalism is. It really is just ridiculously essential. And what's going to happen because, you know, paywalls won't work, because, you know, all these different things that can come into play where people don't want to pay for their news now. How do you financially incentivize journalists to put themselves in dangerous situations because they need to make a living, right? Now, that is a problem that I really want someone smarter than me to solve. I've thought of it. I've tried to solve it. Maybe eventually a light bulb will go off and I'll have an idea, but journalism specifically, because I think it is more important. Now I'm going to get shit for this from many people. It's more important than music, than art, than movies, because it really is how we get our information. And ensuring that that's correct is so, because that's all our decision making is based on that information. That's a problem that really is a conundrum that I have not come close to, you know, answering other than saying putting news bounties out. But then that could, you know, lead to people creating their own news, you know, say, give me $1 million for, you know, to find out if Barack Obama is secretly speaking with, you know, some country, that people can lie. Like, how do you solve that? I really want to know. And I hope a listener has some great idea and creates a startup. We will have you on the second you do. And I will ask you tons of questions. But that's one where I'm really concerned about.
So the way I like to think about this is breaking it down to what I consider basic information theory. When this kind of bleeds into intellectual property, everything derives from a root answer or root concept here, or a root truth. And that root truth, as we've observed it, is that information is a derivative of energy, whether that down to like the quantum information level, information is a derivative from the energy that exists. When you transit information, when you move information, you are moving mass or energy that information can be derived from. If you expand that out, once information has been granted, you have it, you possess it, it is there. The value, the energy that is expended is in moving that mass, is in moving things, is in perhaps creating that inference or extracting that information from that energy. You expand that all the way back up to the way the internet works. The idea is that when you send information, those bits can be replicated infinitely. Right, you can literally, once it has arrived at this location, you can expend a cost, a very close to zero cost, and duplicate that information. So this is why, you know, Napster became very interesting very early on. MP3s became such a big bubble because suddenly, and this applies to the newspaper industry, the magazine industry, everything. Suddenly, because we are digitizing things, the consumption of that type of media no longer becomes about the physical good, the record, the newspaper, the book. It no longer becomes about the physical thing of which there is a finite copy, and it becomes simply about the digital representation of the content contained therein. And once that's possible, you look at it from basic economic theory, and you say, you know, supply and demand. There is a finite demand, a limited number of people that want one specific piece of content, one specific song, one specific issue of a newspaper, whatever it may be. If you can copy it infinitely, and there's an infinite potential, given the let's say every computer on Earth is like the upper bounds on that, right? If you copy something, have the potential to copy something infinitely, you can treat it as effectively infinite. And when there is an infinite supply and a limited demand, then therefore the cost approaches zero or is zero. It is one of the most basic math equations that you can kind of draw out. Once something digital recognize it has a value of zero, then you start to kind of pop your head above your little piece of graph paper where you've written this equation down, and you look around at the world around you, and you see, you know, newspapers, you know, failing left and right. Audio industry struggling because, you know, the previous model it doesn't apply to digital content, period. What they're trying to do, everything that these companies are trying to do is basically take the previous model and take pieces of it, kind of rotate it a little bit and figure out how to fit it into this digital format. And the problem is that it just doesn't work. We have to step back, reevaluate things based on information theory, and recognize that infinitely copyable content, digital property, ideas, intellectual property, it's not property. It is a infinitely copyable piece of information. The reason an intellectual property doesn't work is because anybody can come up with an idea anywhere in the world. And oftentimes you look back at history, and very commonly many people come up with the same idea at the same time, right? That's part of how things work as a society. The value that you come to the table is when you provide a service. Now, the service or the good, in the case of the traditional media, it's traditionally the good, the record, the vinyl record, or the physical newspaper, which costs things to produce, costs things to move. The different representation is, in the information age, the only things of value that we have are A, finite assets. Bitcoin is interesting in this regard, and I'll get to that in a second. Or B, services. So the service of moving data, the service of streaming a piece of data, whether that be music or serving a website where that content is made available, that act is chargeable. So that's like at the ISP level, right? Where that is at, like, the, if you want to think about it as a mesh network, when we can get there, is at the mesh level. Now, Bitcoin is interesting. It's unique because for the first time, we have a token, a digital asset that can be locked, that has a finite amount. And the only way that that is enforced, it's not that the digital asset has a actual finite amount. You can copy the blockchain as many times as you want, and now there's 20 bajillion gajillion different Bitcoin out there, right? It doesn't matter. Because what actually is valuable here is a piece of information. It is a piece of information that is not transmitted. And that piece of information is the private key. The value of Bitcoin is in the scarcity introduced through this, the non-availability of the private key for that specific entry in that perfectly distributed ledger, right? Again, the value of Bitcoin is in the scarcity of the private key, which never touches or is never shared, and you have a disincentive to share, because that it once you have shared that information, it drops the value of that asset to zero. Once you've burned a private key, it is burned forever, and because that is the most pure mathematical representation of underlying information theory.
Eric, so why did you ask me to give you my private key the other day? I wrote it down for you, sent it over, you said you keep it safe. You had a place in Tokyo, trading card, something like that.
You should have labeled it private key here.
I wish I could tell you with a straight face without sounding sketchy, like, I have no idea what you're talking about, but I have no idea what you're talking about, knowing full well that that's suspicious.
And in addition to that suspicion, one of the comments I wanted to make about what you said was interesting, one of the specific things you said that was interesting to me was basically how, you know, information's free and how it's replicated and it turns digital. And, you know, I don't think that it's about getting that information and putting it, making it accessible to others. That is the cheapest it's ever been. Journalism now, the jobs are just going down the toilet. There are not jobs in this industry, which means, so how are we going to monetize this, right? Is it going to be someone using, you know, an app like Streamium to say, hey, you know, I know you want to check out the Ferguson events that happened earlier this year, good example, or that was last year, I'm sorry, but you know, you could archive that and say, you know, you only have to pay $1 for an hour, but I need to be monetized with this, which I love. I love that idea. That's one of the reasons we got on this topic. And I absolutely adore that thinking and that line of thinking. But I also think, how can we ensure that the information reported is true if there's no video evidence? Yes, there's going to be ways that, you know, the Oracle problem can be solved, which is something one of the projects I'm working on is involved with. But how do you fix that? And, you know, that's really difficult, and it is something where I've always viewed content from a music or a media perspective. And when you view it from the news and from the basis information you need, it's important. And, you know, there is something I want to speak with in a minute, but I think both of you guys want to reply to this, and it involves Apple Music. And I think that point is, if you make the service easy and good enough for people to access it, they will pay for it. But with journalism, this is a bit different.
So let me address the journalism concern, because I one of the reasons that I became so excited about purely decentralized concepts, and specifically Bitcoin, was because I was watching very carefully as the Arab Spring, if you will, sort of unfolded a number of years ago. And what was interesting to me was this beginning of an inkling that we could have this true citizen journalism. Where what happened in Tahrir Square in Egypt, for example, is there was grave abuses of power and travesties, utter travesties being executed on people who were there in the square. And this sort of strikes again at one of the earlier theories here, is these people were live streaming from their phone the things that were happening on the ground. Like, at some point, I had like 7 or 8 different streams open at once, watching from like different trusted entities, like people that So your citizen would average like to start live streaming and recording. I forget what service they used at that point. It might have even been Twitch. But they were live streaming any way that they could to the ground, from the ground. And naturally, what emerged was people who were like, well, these streams come and go. How can we make this more reliable? So like individuals went out there and like committed to doing 24/7 streaming and got together like with a small group of people and did that. They said, there is no way we're going to let the government get away with this. There's no way we're going to let the police forces get away with this. There's no way. We have to record this and share to the world so that something can be done about what's happening here. This is a grave violation of human rights. This was true in the Occupy protests. This is true in a number of protests over the past like 5 to 6 years, I would say. And it was really interesting to me because I saw the emergence of something that could replace centralized journalism, where rather than relying on a specific news institution to do these things, it can definitely be the people going out and doing this because we're pushing the availability of the technology to do this out into the hands of the people to do it. And that is just amazing to me. Now, the government's response to this, it's to control the information. And what they did is they shut down the internet. And so suddenly now you've completely removed the ability to do anything like this. And that is why... this is a practical application. This actually happened. People died as a result of this. The government came in and shut down the internet. And because you've stopped the flow of information, you've stopped the ability of the people to defend themselves. It's a fundamental human right at this point. Now that it's there, we have to take advantage of it and we have to protect it. So we have to build a truly decentralized alternative to the internet that can't be shut down.
And as a follow-up to that, the popularity recently of Jot has been awesome. And I don't know if you guys have been following this app. It's a lot like FireChat. You know, it allows mesh networking on a local scale to talk to people. And, of course, teens are using it like crazy in their schools. But that, to me, is awesome. It's an awesome testing ground, to be fair. And I hope that more people embrace that. I really do. And I think that, you know, I think they will. It's just a matter of the right app with the right design and the right features needs to come out and, you know, enable it for mobile. But speaking of things that are available on mobile right now, I really was dying to talk about Apple Music because it launched today. And as I say that, I get grins of, I think, like, oh, I hate Apple from people that are recording this. And I kind of do too begrudgingly, you know. It's like Comcast when you're going, like, I hate my Comcast internet, but you don't have a choice. I do have a choice with Apple. And I still choose Apple. And I always like to say that, like, I begrudgingly do it. I think there's a lot of things they do great. I think there's a lot of things that make them a really evil company, and I would rather not use their products. Apple Music, for me, right now, gets a B-, and I will tell you why. I can't use it on my desktop, on, you know, my Mac or my PC. I can only use it on mobile. It does have pretty much everything I'd want, but the search function isn't as good as Spotify. And, you know, it really needs, like, one or two other things, which, you know, Eric has mentioned in the past to me. I don't know if he has made it on the show, but it needs a way to access the music that's not in the Apple catalog, right? And I don't mean the Beatles. I mean, like, Whitey Cracker or Lil B or, you know, things that maybe, you know, aren't very popular but really need to be heard. And, you know, now that I've used it, I have it on my iPad and my iPhone. I played around. I did some searches for artists. It's pretty neat. Like, it works pretty well. It's built in. There's a 3-month free trial. I like all these things. But it didn't seal the deal with me. I'm still thinking of keeping Spotify. I want an all-in-one service, and I don't mind paying for it, but I want easier integration to SoundCloud. I want easier integration to music that is not on that grid. And that's really where it comes down to. And it really has a lot to do with the pay for content thing, because I don't know. I know Eric is very anti-Apple Music and Apple in general. James, I'm not sure where you stand. I don't know if you're both Spotify users, but I think you are. And, of course, you know, there's all of the great music projects that Eric is directly involved with, which I always like him to – I don't like to say too much on, and he'll unveil when he's ready. But, you know, I want an awesome on-demand – because the way I listen to music is I want to hear this song now. That's it. I don't want to hear anyone else playing it. I don't want to hear something like it. I want to hear that. That's the way I listen to music. It still hasn't been done perfectly. So I've been dying to go on this rant for Apple Music and saying I really hoped a lot because one of my heroes was behind it, but it's only getting a B- for me until the near future. So I'm interested, too, to the audience. Shoot me up. You know, I just said shoot me up like I'm on heroin. No. Hit me up on like Twitter. And you don't need to hit up the Decentralized, but please do if you want. Either Decentralize All or Tony Swish. Tell me what you think of Apple Music. And from from a perspective of someone who obviously knows technology because you're listening to the show, you probably are into Bitcoin or you're into, you know, mesh networking, whatever it may be. Tell me what you think, because I want other people's perspectives, because it's really important to me when I have judgments and I'm so into something like this.
Tony, I honestly didn't realize I'd even heard of Apple Music until I saw the show notes, which was like literally this morning. I was looking over the show notes and I was like, Apple Music, what the heck is that? iTunes? Is that iTunes? Are they rebranding iTunes? And apparently we've talked about it before and it just never drew the dot. So Apple Music is a Spotify competitor. So like when you're online, you can listen to music.
What happened was, remember when Apple bought Beats? They didn't buy Beats for the headphones. They bought it for the Beats Music
streaming service.
That's really why they bought it. And they acquired Dr. Dre and Trent Reznor from Nine Inch Nails Services, so they kind of had a heavy influence in this. The thing is, it's funny, because it's 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Tuesday, and they still haven't released the iTunes update that lets people with Macs use Apple Music. So I can't talk about that feature right now, but that to me is more essential than the mobile. Because mobile I use in my car, but this I use at home, and I have a nice receiver with AirPlay. It's very simple and seamless, and I want to continue that. But Apple needed to make this decision, this move, because the move's away from owning, as we were talking about, owning a track. They want access to a catalog.
So this is the pivot then, and I'll ask a question first. So what happens when I'm not connected to the internet? How can I listen to my Apple Music music?
You would need to back it up just like Spotify, where you would need to like listen offline, and you would have to use local storage. And I haven't played with that enough to see how well it works, so I can't give you an official comment on that, but yeah,
so,
basically that.
So basically what they're doing here, and all streaming services are doing this, is they're providing a service. They're not actually giving you the information except like one time when you click the play button and then it's gone. They explicitly make it difficult for you to save that information unless it's like a feature built into the app and then you still have to pay for it, right? That's like arbitrary limitation. Once the data has already been transferred, that's an artificial limit. And I don't think that economic model works out. But what they're doing is they're making sure you have to keep coming back to them and paying for the service. And that's why I don't like Apple.
I understand that, but there's a lot of services that do this, and I think it does work. Netflix does this. Spotify does this. Hulu does this. I think it's right now the best solution. I don't think it's going to be, the ultimate conclusion of all of this, but I don't mind it, honestly. If I have a nice interface, I've been a Spotify subscriber for 3 years, I think, or 2 or 3 years, and I've never had an issue paying for it and saving playlists. Now, I see your point, though. Like, I am a very, what's the word? I'm a very friendly attitude of what yours is. I want something in the middle, honestly, but what you're saying, it'll be interesting to see where we're at in 5 years. I really wish I had that time machine, and we create the Spotify and Apple Music killer, because we should. So who knows, though? Either way, it's a fascinating topic for me, and I loves my music, and I have to say that. So,
Tony, your passion always comes through when you talk about music, and you have really good insights to share. We definitely hope our listeners do reach out and share your thoughts, whether on Apple Music, on the crisis in Greece. Maybe if you're a listener in Greece and you have any thoughts on where we're wrong, please let us know. But you kind of asked my opinion on all this, Tony, and I guess I'm sort of apathetic about it. Maybe I shouldn't be. I love music myself. I love it. but I really miss listening to vinyl, but it's been a while for me. But I think ultimately, I guess I'm more impressed by the decentralized projects that are out there. And we've had some really cool content tech projects on the show before. We've got Alexandria. We've got Steve Albini, who's not working on a project, but definitely has some good commentary. Tony's signaling to me that he has a commentary on my apathy about music before we close here.
Yeah, and all it is there's nothing wrong with you having apathy toward music. We all have things we love, and we all have things we just don't care about. And, that's really it. So, whatever you care about, that's what you care about.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like I said, I think I care deeply about music. I'm just way more impressed by these projects. And to sort of close my thought, I guess, the project we're having on next in our interview, Streamium, is probably one of the most interesting ones we've had on the show so far. So we hope you enjoy it.
Joining us today is Manuel Arroz, the creator of Proof of Existence, a former crypto financial engineer at BitPay, and the founder and engineer at a Bitcoin-powered streaming service, Streamium. Manuel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, Eric. Thank you for having me. Hey, James. Hey, Tony.
So for the listeners who aren't aware, Manuel is a former coworker of ours who's gone off to start Streamium. Manuel, why don't you tell us a little bit about Streamium and why is it important?
Sure. So Streamium is a fully decentralized app that allows you to broadcast a video in exchange for Bitcoin using the Bitcoin payment channel protocol. It originally started as a way to showcase the payment channel technology. We got together with a bunch of friends in the weekends trying to figure out the best way to show how cool the payment channel technology is, and we came up with the idea of having a stream of payments in exchange for a stream of video live. So it's a fully decentralized app. I mean, it has a really simple web server where you get the static files from, but apart from serving static HTML and JavaScript files, all the application works in a peer-to-peer way. It's using WebRTC for the data communication between the viewers and the streamers, and Bitcoin for payments. So apart from the static file server and the peer.js, which is a framework we're using, it also has a sort of meeting point server where peers connect to be able to do peer discovery. All the application works peer-to-peer.
So what's the significance, I guess, with this the peer-to-peer streaming model? So obviously we have something like Spotify, something like Pandora, very popular. What's new? What's important about sort of the peer-to-peer model with Streamium?
So we think there's several advantages in decentralizing the live streaming. One is that, especially when live streaming where you can monetize the content live. One advantage is that it's actually pretty hard to monetize content, and especially live streaming content in most of developing countries. I'm originally from Buenos Aires, Argentina, and for example, in Argentina we don't have access to PayPal accounts to say I want to charge other Argentinians or even my neighbor in Buenos Aires for something I do online. I cannot use PayPal for that. So the reach of most mainstream and traditional financial instruments is very limited in most developing countries. We think that using a decentralized and frictionless payment system like Bitcoin for content monetization, in particular for live streaming, will be a way to allow many people in the developing world to monetize the content they create. On the other hand, the aspect where live video goes via a decentralized protocol, which is WebRTC, also makes it uncensorable, because there's no central server that has control over how the video gets distributed, and it's completely peer-to-peer. I mean, from the streamer's computer to the viewer's computer directly. So it also sort of takes away many problems in content discrimination for live streaming.
Absolutely. I love your project, and we've had actually a chat in the past where I mentioned that one of the things here in America that's big is combat sports, and there's a lot of, you know, very low-level events that really maybe one person might want to stream their MMA fight or something like that, and your service is something that's really built and ideal for that. And let me put it this way. If I were to come out with Streamium, that would have been the reason for me. What was your reason? What was your reasoning other than what you mentioned about it being a new market and how many, you know, people would be able to use it? Was there maybe one event you saw, you go, you know, I wish I could stream this, and you couldn't, or something like that that made the light bulb go off?
Yeah, well, as I told you before, the original idea of the project was to showcase the payment channels protocol, so it was more like a technical challenge and a way to show how Bitcoin is awesome and how you can do stuff that you cannot do with fiat currencies. But there's also a real problem that we experience, and it is access to paid content from Argentina, for example. There's a lot of paid content that we cannot access just because we don't have the means of paying. So it's really common to use piracy to get those types of contents in Argentina, because there's, even if you want to pay for it, you cannot. So we see this as a way to sort of enable new ways of allowing legal activities to occur and replacing the illegal content consumption that is the only way that many people have in many countries. But to answer your question, it was honestly a matter of showcasing a technology and it's also a really visual way of understanding a payment channel, because when your money runs out, the stream cuts off. So that's why we chose live video.
So Manuel, it seems like this is something that might not even be possible without something like Bitcoin. Would you say that that's a fair statement? Is Bitcoin integral to Streamium, or could this have been built with just regular U.S. dollars?
So the underlying payment mechanism is using Bitcoin payment channels, which is only possible using Bitcoin. I mean, you could do something similar with a centralized solution, but the truth is the cost of let me first explain a little bit how payment channels works, so that it's clear how it's only possible with Bitcoin. Payment channels is a protocol that allows you to conceptually create a stream of payment between two peers or two people or two pieces of software, whatever you want, in a way that instead of having a discrete amount that is paid from the payer to the payee, you have a continuous event in time where money flows from the payer to the payee. I don't know if payee is an actual word, so, but I guess you understand. So instead of having a discrete event where A pays B X amount of Bitcoin, you have a flow over time of money between A and B. This is actually the high-level behavior, but internally the protocol works in a way that two parties can sort of agree on a contract on how the money will move. It involves three different types of transactions. I don't want to get into much detail, but the idea is that you first, the payer first commits funds to a shared address, and then the funds start moving from the shared address to the person receiving the funds, or in Streamium's case, the streamer, in transactions that alter the paid amount in really small ways. So you can have a granularity as small as one Satoshi for each update of payments. And all these transactions that are updated are actually off-chain, so there's not thousands of transactions going to the blockchain. You only have one transaction when you open the payment channel and one transaction when you close it. And in between, all the transactions are peer-to-peer. I mean, not only peer-to-peer, are just private between the two parties doing the contract. So all this in a centralized system would be very expensive due to the cost of each transaction, both for the central party and for the communication protocol and everything. And it's honestly the solution to, well, one of the solutions to micropayments in Bitcoin, because Bitcoin also has, we've been talking about how Bitcoin is not really fit for micropayments in a general sense, but payment channels sort of allows you to have a stream of micropayments between two parties and have the cost be really low, because you only need to pay transaction fees when you open and when you close the channel. So it's a really promising technology. It would be possible to implement something similar with a centralized solution, but it would be very expensive and of course you would continue having counterparty risk, which is a general property of Bitcoin, but I guess in the case of micropayments, it also has a cost in performance and an actual monetary cost.
Thank you for breaking that down for our listeners, Manuel. I mean, we've talked about payment channels a little bit before, but this is really the most compelling use case we've seen of it so far. And I'm still trying to wrap my head around it, so it's really cool to see what Streamium's doing. I know you said you didn't want to get too much into details, but I kind of want to ask you, what are some of the theories, white papers, other Bitcoin space engineers you've been looking at as you've been working on this project, both with payment channels and with other kind of implementations of the peer-to-peer model in Streamium?
I don't know if I understood your question, but there's many other people working in with payment channels in the Bitcoin space. There's actually, I think 20 minutes ago, Sean Wilkinson, the lead developer of Storage, I never pronounced that correctly. 30 minutes ago, he sent an email to the Bitcoin development list, like saying, hey, we are all these people are trying to work on payment channels. We should work towards standardizing a BIP. Standardizing the protocol. He names Storage, Bitmesh, Streamium, and Joystream. I also know that Mike Hearn and Matt Corallo are the ones who wrote the first payment channel, working payment channel implementation. To clarify what we mean by standardizing, theoretically, payment channels existed for a long time. I think I read about them the first time 2 years ago. So there's not many good resources on what they are on a technical level and how they work and why they work. And there's also lots of questions about the security of the protocol. So there are many similar approaches that are called payment channels. For example, I think Bitcoin J's implementation is the most solid with respect to the best interface on how to create an app using payment channels, because they actually thought about production use. In Streamium, we use our own implementation in JavaScript, which is based on Bitcore, a JavaScript Bitcoin library. And it has a slightly different model in the transaction protocol, which is basically what we had to do to adapt it more specifically to Streamium, but the basic idea is the same. So what would be good to do is to get together with all the people working on payment channels, and also open the discussion to all the Bitcoin development community, of course, and try to standardize the best and most secure and most useful protocol, which we can call payment channels, and standardize that as a BIP. So that future implementations can just read the BIP and don't have to go scanning the whole web, the whole internet for resources and explanation on how payment channels work at a protocol level. And there's still many open questions. The biggest one is, it's not a question, but the biggest thing that can change with regards to the protocol is the inclusion of op, check time, verify. I'm not sure how the opcode is called, but the new opcode that has been recently merged to Bitcoin Master, which allows checking for a similar thing to the lock time of a transaction, where you lock a transaction in time and it will only be valid after a certain block. But you can, with this new opcode, you can have that check inside a Bitcoin script. So it will allow for more complex behaviors in the Bitcoin scripting language regarding when a transaction is valid or when which conditions apply to a transaction. And there's a possibility of using that new opcode to simplify the payment channel protocol. So instead of needing three different transactions, one for the commitment, one for the refund, and one for the payment, you can simplify all that in a single transaction with an if statement in the script, where you have an if depending on check lock time verify, and in case the time has passed, you only need one private key, and in case the time is not yet fulfilled, you need both parties' private keys. So sorry, I got into many technical details there, but well, not details, but the thing is, there's a possibility of really simplifying the payment channel protocol by using this new opcode, and that's one of the biggest things I think we should be discussing when standardizing the VIP.
You know, I've been excited about payment channels for a very long time, and there's been numbers of implementations like you've described. The thing that's really compelling to me is you found perhaps the first real-world use case, and it's such a natural and obvious fit. I think that's amazing. I'm curious, and you talked a little bit about, you know, where you're from. You're from Argentina. Can you talk about, you know, how you found the people to work on this with you? Like, how did you find the team, and how did you guys come to this?
Sure. So in Argentina, there's a pretty big Bitcoin community. Yeah, and the Bitcoin developer community has been growing pretty fast in the last couple of years. We initially got together with Sergio Lerner, which you might know, you must know from, he was, I'm not sure if he still is, but he used to be a chief security officer for Bitcoin Foundation. He's from Argentina too. And we sort of met at the Latin American Bitcoin Conference in 2013. We met with him and other developers interested in Bitcoin and started a group called BitAires, which was an initiative to gather all the Bitcoin developers or software developers or makers in Buenos Aires interested in Bitcoin. And since then, we've been having sort of informal meetings, just talking about what we are building or what we think of Bitcoin. That sort of extended into the future to more and more informal gatherings. We ended up also having people who are not developers in the group that joined us just to for dinner or just to chat about Bitcoin and. But with a maker mindset, I mean, not just talking about the price or mining or how to set up a wallet, but just get together and talk about how to actually do stuff with Bitcoin. And from those meetings, one of the guys had the idea to get together and do a hackathon. So at that time, I was working at BitPay with Esteban Ordano and Shemel Shardi. We were all working at BitPay down in Buenos Aires. And there was also a couple of other developers and members of BitAires that were interested in doing a hackathon. So we decided to get together on a Sunday and started brainstorming about which ideas we would want to turn into something. And we were all really excited about payment channels, so we started discussing possible ideas on how to show payment channels. And actually, Esteban was the one who came out with the idea of using live streaming to, in exchange for a payment stream. Because actually, the original name for streaming was PayStream. So our idea was to show that in exchange for a stream of video, the viewer has to give the streamer a stream of payments. Then we changed the name to Streamium, which seemed more self-explanatory than PayStream. But yeah, so I think that answers your question, James. The three of us working at BitPay had a lot of tools we've been working on, like all the Bitcore library. Also, a couple of other developers joined us. And a couple of other friends who have other talents, non coding related, but which proved really useful in launching the app.
That's such a fantastic story. I love hearing that people can meet like that and actually construct things from the open source tools they've pushed out the door, which is fantastic. Okay, so you mentioned something there about the maker mindset. Did I hear that correctly? Can you go into yep. detail as to what the maker mindset is and what that means to you?
Sure. A small comment on what I said, what I just said. We also really liked the notion of a group of friends getting together in Buenos Aires, which I mean, and innovating in a financial technology, which we know was impossible 6 or 7 years ago without Bitcoin, and we were really motivated by the fact that there actually still is this new huge opportunities of creating lots of financial instruments on top of Bitcoin from anywhere in the world. I see that what happened with software in general in the 80s and the 90s and with the web and internet in the 90s where anywhere in the world you could get together and if you had an interesting team and motivation, you could build really new stuff and innovate. The same is happening now with Bitcoin. I mean, anyone with a computer that can connect to the internet and be part of the Bitcoin network can really innovate in super interesting ways and really change the financial technology landscape in the following years. So that's really motivating for us. Talking about the maker mindset, I don't have much to say about that. It's just I really like new technology. In general, I try to work with technology that is in a really early stage of maturity, because there's a lot of potential to build with maybe little effort, build something that has a lot of value. My sort of maker philosophy is to get to know new technologies as much as possible in the technical details, and then some good ideas will come from that knowledge, and if you have the right skills, you can execute interesting prototypes that may turn into actually valuable applications and maybe even businesses.
I love the way you said that about bringing a product of value, because I do really like Streamium. In fact, for a minute there, I was kind of browsing on the site of how easy it really is to use. And I'm on a terrible computer with a terrible connection on the other one that I'm using, and it still is really, really simple. So, you know, first of all, good job on that. I think that a lot of people will try this out, maybe, you know, just messing around, and they'll be like, this is the easiest streaming service I've ever seen. And the only possible, you know, issue that would come up, I see, is, you know, getting people acclimated to Bitcoin. And with that all said, you know, one of the features that I didn't see and that I wish was there, and I don't necessarily know if it's something they're planning for, is would you ever intend to create maybe an audio-only stream where people can maybe broadcast a concert or broadcast a live podcast, something like that?
Yeah, so the current version of Streamium is really different from what we launched a month ago. We've been doing some serious work on the UI front, and for example, we added a chat feature two weeks ago. We added the ability to stream your screen instead of your webcam a week ago, and we sort of decided to launch with the minimum app that people could use and that showed the value of payment channels, but we know it's very incomplete right now, and that many people are suggesting really good improvements, like you have, Tony, and we try to focus the new feature development or all the change development on what the community requests or comments. that's another good mindset to have when building apps. Instead of focusing on what your views are of how people will use the app, launch the app as soon as possible and actually talk to users about what they want. And actually, specifically about broadcasting audio only, this has been requested a lot, and it's really, really simple to implement. And so we always evaluate new ideas from the community based on the cost it has for us to develop and the amount of people requesting it. So it's probably one of the next things we'll work on, because it's just disabling the video. It will need a few changes in the UI so that you don't show the actual black box where the screen would be, but it's really, really a low-hanging fruit, so we're probably going to implement that in the following month.
So Manuel, you mentioned the importance of kind of this process of talking to your users, and we have a chance for you to talk to a user now. One of our audience members has a question for you. Doug Scribner asks, how are smart contracts used in Streamium? Or what kind of contracts are available to streamers and viewers? And I know kind of one of the first of these is kind of the payment channel kind. Can you describe sort of what the smart contract role is in that and maybe other parts of the service?
Yeah, so maybe I didn't explain this correctly, but payment channels is a protocol which can be sort of grouped into the smart contracts category. Smart contracts in general are you still there?
We are still here.
Yeah, sorry. My screen froze for a second. So, smart contracts is a really wide. I mean, it's a broad category of protocols in which contracts or relationships between two parties interacting in an economic way set the terms by which they will interact in a computer program. So conceptually, this concept has been around for many years, more than 10 years. I've seen essays by Nick Szabo talking about this in the 90s. I don't know. I'm not sure about that date, but people have been talking about smart contracts before Bitcoin, which is awesome. And the concept is that you take some of the interactions between two parties that are doing an economic transaction and take those rules and write them down in a program. So the theoretical implication of this is that you reduce the trust the two parties need to have with each other, because if they trust the contract, they don't need to trust the other party as much. So there's a reduction in mental cost for the people doing the interaction if they use smart contracts. And conceptually, it's really simple to, well, not simple, but it's intuitive to think that whenever you program something and you have a computer execute the rules of something, you can, if you trust that program, you can make that interaction in a less trusted way. This happens in a lot of cases. In case of payment channels and Streamium in particular, Streamium is an application that only uses payment channels as a smart contract. There's no actual interface for creating different kinds of smart contracts or more complex smart contracts between the two parties. We do plan to allow more complex interactions within the payment channel contract, which are, for example, micro tipping, so you can, instead of just paying for the seconds you watch, you can tip in a certain point of the video because you want to tip for whatever reason, and that's part of the same contract. It's just part of the protocol by which the two parties exchange bitcoins for the video. So the actual smart contract that is the payment channel is really has a lot of potential outside of just charging for each second of video. It also has a lot of potential outside of Streamium and outside of live streaming. So there are a couple of other people working on payment channels. And I see it as one of the first smart contracts we as a community are exploring. I guess multisig was sort of the first approach to smart contracts. I don't know if everyone will agree in categorizing multisig as a smart contract, but it is some sort of writing in a piece of software, which is really simple. It's just the multisig script, the rules of how the bitcoins will be handled. So in multisig, you specify which public keys can sign the release of the funds, and in payment channels, you're writing down in the program how the coins will move and how the refund strategy will be, and etc. I mean, and I really think that's one of the biggest potentials of Bitcoin. I mean, smart contracts, in the sense that specifying the behavior of money in a permissionless and decentralized with no middleman way is something that couldn't be done before. And it will, I think it will unlock a lot of new use cases for money and economic interaction.
Okay, so we're coming to a close here for our allotted time, but we've got another question from one of our viewers, and this is from Wayne Vaughn. Do you have plans to allow Streamium to multicast streams to hundreds or thousands of users?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I didn't mention this, but one of the big difficult or the big questions about Streamium is scalability. Given that it's completely peer-to-peer, the streamer, the person broadcasting the video, needs to send the video to all the peers separately. There's no central channel of distribution or any way to distribute this in a more efficient way. So it's really limited in the amount of viewers that can connect to the stream, given that the upload bandwidth limits the amount of clients that can connect and receive the stream. That's actually one of our plans. We're actually considering building a company out of this idea, which is providing a service that allows streamers to broadcast the video in a different way, and in exchange for the service of distribution, to charge a small fee that comes directly from the payment channel. So the idea is to modify the payment channel protocol and allow a third party to receive some funds in exchange of helping in the content distribution. So payments will still be completely peer-to-peer, and there will be no middleman there, but streamers will be able to use a centralized service to distribute the video content, which has a lot of implications and disadvantages, but we think it will also add value to streamers wanting to broadcast to a lot of viewers. There's also many people interested in scaling this in a fully peer-to-peer way. There's a lot of problems with that approach, specifically about how you will charge, how the payment channel will scale onto a decentralized structure for distribution. So the biggest question is, who should you pay, the one distributing the video or the one creating the video, or how you can chain the payment channels in a way that everyone gets what they deserve, and you can be safe if any node in this network fails. But there are many people and really, really talented people thinking about how to extend Streamium to make it scale in a fully peer-to-peer way. We are also really interested in that. I don't think we will dedicate full time to the fully decentralized solution, because it's really a really big task for us, and we think there's also value in the sort of middle point where payment is peer-to-peer and the distribution of the video is centralized. But yeah, that's the answer.
So Manuel, we want to thank you again for joining us. It's been really good to hang out with a former coworker and friend, someone working on something so cool. One of my favorite memories from our time working together at BitPay was late night philosophical conversation on anarchism, economics, other fun things we had with a few of our coworkers. And I kind of wanted to ask you as a final question before we wrap up, why is decentralization important to you sort of philosophically? Do you consider it sort of a value for you? And what is it maybe beyond even just the technical aspects that make it such a motivating force?
Sure. First of all, I thought we weren't discussing about the secret meetings, James. No, I'm kidding. I will not expand very much about this because I don't think it's my area of expertise. But non-technically, I think decentralization is an ongoing trend in history, and decentralization simply means taking something that is valuable sort of moving the ownership of something that has value from the hands of people with power to everyone. So this happened many years ago with the printing press and the ability of copy and share information. Originally, only the church had the power to copy and share books, and they also were like the only literate people that could read them and interpret the meaning. So knowledge was sort of out decentralization of that really valuable thing. And the same happened with many technologies in history. I think decentralization has a lot of really hard technical problems to solve. For anything that brings value to human beings, and Bitcoin is one example of that. I mean, compare how Bitcoin works with how a centralized monetary system work, and you can see that Bitcoin is orders of magnitude more complex. But I think that as we progress in history, technology allows us to decentralize many things that bring value to us, and that it's in the long term it's more efficient for us. I see Bitcoin as one step in this direction, but certainly not the last.
That is such a great way of putting it, Manuel. I guarantee we'll be taking snippets of what you've said today and sharing them out. Those are absolutely fantastic. So I do have one final question, and that is, where can people find you? Where can people find Streamium? Where can people find more thoughts from you on social media and just the World Wide Web at large?
Sure. So the Streamium app is hosted at streamium.io. And most of my social media, what I do is on Twitter, so you can follow me at MARAOC, which is my Twitter handle.
All right, Manuel, thank you so much for spending time with us and our listeners today. We really appreciate your thoughts and feedback. It's always good to hang out with a coworker, so good to see you.
Yeah, same. Thanks for having me, and it was great to have this discussion with you guys.
Decentralized was edited and produced by Chaz Ferguson. Music written and performed by Tony Leeds. You can download past episodes at decentralized.fm or on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/decentralized-podcast. And follow us on Twitter at @decentralizeall.